Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Astonishing Legends Network.
Hey everybody, welcome back. I am so excited about this episode, but for the first time, it comes with a warning. There's a little of what I would call true crime content in this episode, so if that sort of thing is not your bag, be forewarned. You know, I wish we lived in a world where people didn't hurt each other, but we do. And since this podcast takes place in the real world that we all live in, sometimes we gotta go there. So sit back or cuddle up, dim the lights, light a candle, bring the dog over or the cat or both, and get ready to meet the monsters. Here we go. Monsters, Giants, and Little Men from Mars by Daniel Cohen. Chapter 1. The Night Stalker. The monsters arrived in my life in April of 1975, and they have never left. Sometimes I wish they would. But I threw the door open and gave them all such a warm welcome. Is it any wonder that they stayed? As you might recall, in late March of 1975, Mrs. Fuller, the librarian at Brightwood Elementary School, introduced me to my first paranormal bookshelf. She led me into the middle school library, a place forbidden to children under the age of 12, and told me that I could come in and check out books anytime I liked. I was only 8 years old then, a third grader, so I knew this invitation was a big deal. And I was very curious about the books on that shelf. I barely had time to glance at their spines that day before heading back to class. But since that day, over 2 weeks before, I had not been back. Even though I'd been given permission, I was scared. Maybe I was scared of the books. Maybe I was scared of the middle school library. I was definitely scared of Mrs. Fuller, and for no good reason. She had been nothing but kind and welcoming to me. And maybe that was why. There was something about truly kind grown-ups that I simply didn't trust. For now, I carried my special permission to enter the big kid's library like a secret coin in my pocket. I knew it was there, I just wasn't quite sure how or when to spend it. As a third grader, every moment of my school day was accounted for anyway. If I wasn't in class, I was in the cafeteria eating lunch, or if it was recess, I was on the playground. And my Thursday afternoon walks with Evelyn Lee to the reading group where third graders read to the first graders had ended. Besides, maybe Mrs. Fuller hadn't really meant it. Maybe I'd show up, stroll right in, and she'd yell at me to get the hell out. Inconsistent adults who were nice one day and mean the next were the rule in my life, not the exception. Maybe I'd better just keep that coin in my pocket for now, warm in the knowledge that it had once been offered, but never risking learning that it was counterfeit all along. Daylight savings time had come around again, and we sprang forward into days that went on way too long as far as I was concerned. Finishing dinner when it was still light out made the days feel endless. For me, every day already felt endless. After dinner, my dad would clean the kitchen, and my mom would sit in the slowly darkening living room listening to her Matt Monro albums at a very high volume. Matt Monro was a baritone crooner from the 1960s, and his songs were filled with longing, pain, and desire denied. I had no idea who this guy was, but from what I could gather, he spent most of his time either softly leaving someone or telling someone to walk away from him. And either way, it was killing him. There was no way for me, as an 8-year-old, to separate the pain and longing of his songs from what I imagined my mother was feeling. It was overwhelming. Sometimes I would sit in the living room with my mom while she listened, but I wouldn't sit next to her or even near her. I'd curl up like a dog in the corner, wishing I could do something about all the emotions swirling around the room, but not knowing what or how. When the sun finally went down and the room fell into complete darkness, my fear and despair would bloom because I could no longer see my mother, couldn't read her expression. I couldn't tell if she was crying or calm, and with Matt Monro singing so loud, I couldn't hear her either. After a while, the stress of feeling like I needed to do something for my mom, but not being able to, became too much, and I'd sneak away into my bedroom, feeling lonely and like a failure. It was Monday, April 14th, and I was just coming in from recess. Mrs. Fuller cornered me in the hallway outside room 6. "Richie Haddam, where have you been?" She wanted to know why I hadn't stopped by the middle school library yet. Her mood was elevated, either angry or enthusiastic, I wasn't quite sure which. But she was coming on strong and accusatory, so better to assume I was in trouble. At least then I knew the playing field. I went on autopilot and lied. "I was going to come in this week," I said. Just then, my teacher, Ms. Crane, walked up. Mrs. Fuller turned her crazy energy on her. "Say, Karen, can I borrow Mr. Haddam for a while?" Ms. Crane shrugged and said, "Sure, probably glad to be rid of me, or any student, even for a few minutes." So just like that, I'd been abducted once again by Mrs. Fuller. When we got to the middle school library, she brought me all the way over to her desk, then reached inside and brought out a book. "It came in last week and I thought of you right away. I haven't even shelved it yet." My brain noted the verb form of the noun shelf, but my eyes were locked on an absolutely breathtaking book cover. The jacket was bright yellow, with some kind of green sloth-like creature draped over a banner that announced the title of the book: Monsters, Giants, and Little Men from Mars, An Unnatural History of the Americas by Daniel Cohen, Doubleday and Company, 1975. The jacket was already covered in a protective plastic sleeve, and it already had a call number tab at the base of its spine. It was ready to be shelved, but she had held it back and kept it hidden in her desk for me. Maybe Mrs. Fuller could be trusted. Maybe she was on my side after all. We went through the ritual of checking out the book, and mine was the very first signature on the pristine card that lived in the little pocket on the first inside page. I put the book inside my backpack and promised her that I would bring it back in 2 weeks. "Don't worry, Richie," she said. "I know where you live." Then she barked out a deep, rasping smoker's laugh. Did she really know where I lived? Probably. She seemed to know everything else about me, at least everything that mattered. I walked out of that library with something much better than an imaginary coin. Now I had a very real book, and I had never felt so rich. Monsters, Giants, and Little Men from Mars is a, quote, book for young readers about the mysterious creatures that may or may not have roamed the Americas since Europeans arrived. The very first chapter is called Native American Monsters, and are you sitting down? There is no mention of Native Americans or their myths and monsters at all. I'm not dragging Daniel Cohen, not really, not yet. He's very clear in his introduction that he's focusing on American, read North American, storytelling traditions. It is a primarily white Europeans go to America book about the myths and monsters of this new land they discovered, and how those myths and monsters are distinct from European traditions. Where they have werewolves, we have Bigfoot. Where they have vampires, we have chupacabras. Where they have fairies, we have little men from Mars. Now, this is a totally legit angle to approach a very broad topic. He was writing about American folklore, and he was no dummy. He wanted his book to sell. So he celebrated this aspect of Americana at just the right time, 1975. Because the next year was a little thing we called the Bicentennial. And let me tell you, it was a thing. If you weren't there, America in 1976, you just don't know. It was like the 4th of July every single day. People walked around in red, white, and blue suits and dresses if they felt like it, and you couldn't really say shit. There was star-spangled furniture and cars factory-painted red, white, and blue. There were specially minted bicentennial coins and specially printed bicentennial stamps. There were Liberty Bell paperweights and bicentennial beer. Guys, there was even, quote, one for old glory, a bicentennial-themed novelty condom. And if you'll pardon the expression, it came in red, white, and blue. And by the way, if you ever do, go see a doctor. All of which is to say, America in 1976 was very high on its own supply, and a few other things. But I'm getting ahead of myself. We're still back in April of 1975. I waited until I was at home and alone to read Daniel Cohen's book, and as I did, I got a version of the feeling I got when I read Ghosts and Spectres just a few months earlier. I got a feeling of power. A grown-up had taken the time to write a book about monsters, and he was heavily implying that they could exist. But there was more. This book had pictures. Being an 8-year-old, I paged through the entire volume, looking at them first. And on page 142, I saw it for the very first time. There she was. Blurry but clear. Real but vague. Slightly hunched, arms swinging, and giving the most famous side eye of all time. Bigfoot. We all know what I'm talking about. That famous frame from the Patterson-Gimlin film. But I'd never seen it before, never even knew it existed. And now suddenly, here it was. Proof. Or at least, proof enough. Grown-up proof. First ghosts and now this. And this was better, because this was a solid physical being. It was out there in the world, right now for all I knew. So theoretically, I could see Bigfoot one day if I was lucky. Daniel Cohen goes on, discussing some other Bigfoot-style creatures, Momo the Missouri Monster, Yeti, and the skunk ape of the Florida swamps. But they all live too far away from me. Bigfoot was right here in California. Bigfoot was my monster. Cohen's approach to his subjects, which ran from gremlins to sea monsters to extraterrestrials, is friendly, conversational, and indulgent. It's clear he likes having these creatures around. At age 8, this conveyed to me a sense of relaxed authority. His honesty about the possible existence of actual monsters in our world was invigorating. Did all the middle schoolers already know about this? Was this the privilege of being older? The casual acceptance of real-life monsters? The calm knowledge that no matter how far we had advanced in Western civilization, no matter how modern or sane our bicentennial country seemed, there was still a free-floating darkness that hovered over our land, and inside it, strange and ever-morphing life forms that could not and would not be ignored. I wasn't afraid of Bigfoot, not really. If anything, the thought of Bigfoot made me feel lonely in a way I couldn't quite put words to. Weren't monsters supposed to be scary? Maybe there was something wrong with me. How come everything scared me except the things that were supposed to? For a couple of weeks in the middle of April, I seemed immune to any fear of monsters at all. Then on Friday, April 25th, all that changed forever. It was 8 p.m. and my brother John and my cousins Janny and Rob and I were sprawled across their parents' king-size bed, and the only light in the room was the cold blue glow of the television. A show was starting. On the screen, a man wearing a hat walks into a large office and pours himself some coffee. And I guess he's in a good mood because he's whistling. But the office is dark and shadowy and devoid of people. Anyway, this dude goes to his desk, he tosses his hat at the coat rack, misses, and the hat falls in the trash can. Then he sits down at a typewriter, rolls in a clean sheet of paper, and as he begins typing, the cellos kick in, and things start to get serious. He types the word victim. Horns start blaring. The fun tune is turning urgent and ominous. He types the words, "He came at me." Then suddenly the guy looks up, and the lighting all around him changes. The clock stops. The fan stops. We zoom in on him from the front, moving fast in on his face as the violins go crazy. Then we cut to the side of him just as he whips his head in our direction, almost like that picture of Bigfoot, like something is lurching out of the shadows at him. And then I'm suddenly watching my very first episode of Kolchak, the Night Stalker. Now, just in case you have no idea what I'm talking about, Carl Kolchak was a reporter for the INS, the International News Service. And in each episode, he would begin investigating a series of murders that inevitably had a supernatural cause. A werewolf, a vampire, a headless motorcyclist, you know, the classics. The episodes always went the same way. Kolchak would investigate a series of murders and eventually become convinced that the murderer was not human. But no one would believe him. Ultimately, in his quest to gather proof, he would find himself facing down whatever monster was murdering people in Chicago that week, and he would be forced to kill it. Now here's the thing. Kolchak was not cool. He wasn't a badass. He wasn't born with any special powers or skills. He wasn't told by a wizard that it was his destiny to rid the world of evil. He wasn't born into a grand line of monster killers or vampire slayers. He didn't like killing monsters. He didn't want anything to do with monsters. It just sort of worked out that way. In the world of the show, it was implied that most of his job and the stories that he covered for the news service weren't about supernatural things at all. He was just a normal reporter. It was only when occasionally his cases involved a monster that they actually went ahead and made a TV episode out of them. And in the climax of these episodes, when he was facing down the monster, he was always terrified. But somehow, he always managed to kill the monster. He always managed to defeat the thing that was scaring him to death. And then the next week, he would do it all over again. And nobody ever knew, and nobody ever thanked him. This was a grown-up show, a one-hour drama, and I didn't have much experience with those. It all felt very real. All the grown-ups were acting the way real grown-ups acted. angry, suspicious, irritated, and scared. It was still light when we started watching the show, but dark when the show ended. And the emotions that were stirring up inside me threatened to become overwhelming. The suspense was almost too much for me. The episode that night was called The Spanish Moss Murders. And if I understood it correctly, it was about a Louisiana swamp monster named Paramalfay that was being dreamed into reality by some guy at a sleep research facility. An actual nightmare come to life. Ultimately, it was up to Kolchak to kill the swamp monster by stabbing it with a wooden stake carved from a bayou gum tree. I had never seen a show where supernatural stuff was happening in a modern setting and with a mostly straight face. The fact that this monster was wandering around downtown Chicago made it seem absolutely undeniably real to me. And if this Kolchak guy could run into a swamp monster in Chicago, God only knows what I might find in Monterey Park. At the end of the episode, Kolchak realizes he has to hunt down the Paramalfay and kill it. If he doesn't, it will kill him. He goes down into the sewers below the streets of Chicago. He wades around in the waist-deep water searching for this thing. And when it rises up out of the muck, towering over him, he does something absolutely amazing, something I will never forget. He runs away. Or he tries to anyway, but have you ever tried to run away from a monster in a dream? It feels just like what Kolchak is doing now, running through waist-deep water, unbearably slow. He finally barely manages to kill the thing. And afterwards, I can only describe what I felt as an emotional orgasm. The suspense rose to a climax, then ended. There had been closure, a conclusion. That was something that never happened in my real life. In my real life, my fear just built and built and built, and then slowly receded over a period of hours or days. The Night Stalker was all about building up fear and then having it crescendo in a terrifying action sequence. It completed the cycle. It resolved. I was hooked. Carl Kolchak was a hero to us children, the patron saint for all of us who lived with fear that we could never quite conquer. He wasn't better than us. He wasn't braver than us. He was us. And I mean that more literally than you might think, because there was something very childlike about Carl Kolchak, at least the weekly TV show version of him. He was always getting yelled at by his boss and threatened by the police. He was always about to get in trouble with some authority figure. And that's how kids feel all the time, or at least we did back in the 70s. Also, the TV series Kolchak didn't smoke or drink, and he seemed to have absolutely no interest in girls. He was weirdly and wonderfully pre-adolescent. And there was one other thing that rarely gets mentioned about the show, but for me, it was so important it felt essential. In almost every single case, when Kolchak finally tracked the monster to its lair, he was trapped with it. In that sewer, or at the top of a partially constructed skyscraper, or miles underground in an unfinished government storage facility. Help was out of reach, and there was no escape. He couldn't run away, even though he wanted to. It was kill or be killed. And isn't that how childhood felt? No choice. Nowhere to run. You were trapped. Trapped with your parents, your teachers, your life. The difference between us and Kolchak was that Kolchak always learned how to defeat his monsters. But us kids never did. After seeing that first episode, I had a mythic structure that I immediately applied to my own life. I would imagine myself as Carl Kolchak pretty much all the time. I was almost always alone, so in my mind I was investigating some really scary thing that I knew I'd sooner or later have to face. and I would talk to myself in the way that Kolchak would narrate the episodes. These fantasies were always best when I was at my school at night. I would get dragged to PTA meetings with my parents, which were held at Brightwood in the community room. But I would always, and I mean always, find a few minutes to sneak out and walk around the campus. Did you ever do this? I'd stand in the dark and stare into the empty classrooms where I'd just been a few hours before. What had once been loud and busy and filled with life was now dark and silent and strange. I thought about the book I had brought home from the library, Monsters, Giants, and Little Men from Mars. The monsters in Daniel Cohen's book didn't typically murder anyone. And maybe that's why, more than anything, I felt sorry for them. Bigfoot was just a misfit weirdo who wanted to be left alone. I knew the feeling. But Kolchak's monsters were of a different sort. They meant us harm. And if we weren't careful, they'd kill us. Make no mistake, I wanted there to be monsters the way that there were monsters in Kolchak, the Night Stalker. Because there were ways to kill those monsters. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be brave and kill the things that scared me. What would I do if a swamp monster appeared? Would I run away in fear? Or curl up in a ball and fall on the ground and wait to be crushed to death? No. I'd stab it with a stake made from bayou gum over and over and over and over until it was dead. In my Kolchak fantasies, I always stood and fought. I always killed the monster. I always won. Chapter 2. The Night Stalker. It was the summer of 1985. Just 10 years later, but is there a bigger 10 years than that between 8 and 18? I had so much now that I didn't have then. Friends, a girlfriend, a growing shelf of paranormal books. And most of all, I had a direction. I was going to be a writer. Maybe I was one already. By that time, I had written 6 television scripts. 3 A-teams, a Riptide, a Remington Steel, and a Hardcastle and McCormick. But I had also written a short story. It was the final exam for a class I had taken at USC that spring semester called Russian Science Fiction, taught by Amy Mandelker. For me, it was transformative. In that class, I learned, for the first time, that modern stories and ancient stories were not so different after all. That every action movie I loved could be broken down into its component parts alongside Greek myths and even stories from the Bible, and at a certain point their basic thematic structure would be the same. I'm sure it's the same way for chemistry students when they learn that the DNA of human beings and bats and bread mold are all exactly the same. If that's actually something they learn, I wouldn't know. I stayed as far away from science classes as I possibly could. That shit's hard. Anyway, the final exam in Amy Mandelker's class was writing a short story. It didn't matter what the story was, what it was about, what the genre was. The only thing that mattered was one thing: that our main character be identifiable as the hero as described by Joseph Campbell in The Hero's Journey. The minute she assigned it, I mean the very instant, something changed inside of me. It was like suddenly becoming aware of a room in your house you never knew existed. I had no idea what my story would be about, but I felt so blessed to realize, to understand on some very deep soul level, that this thing, this activity, this writing of a short story was available to me. It was something that I could do and I would do, and it would be important. My story was about a man in his mid-20s whose older brother worked for a pharmaceutical company that was doing human trials on a PTSD drug that allowed people to relive a specific traumatic memory from their life, but rewrite it like a lucid dream so that it became a new, less destructive, troubling memory. Because I was 18 and the main emotional touch point in my life was my relationship with Michelle, I decided that my main character was stalled out in his life after a bad breakup. This drug trip was going to allow him to relive the final night of this relationship, but understand it and react to it differently than he had when it had actually happened. It was very different from anything I'd ever written before, and I got really emotionally involved in it. And to me, it really felt like something. I remember that when I turned it in, I had absolutely no fear, no sense of awaiting judgment. I was confident and completely emotionally secure. I knew the value of what I had done, and I had a feeling that there might be, no, was, a steady river of short stories or even novels ready to come flowing out of me. But even more than that, I remember getting the assignment back and seeing that the back of the final page was covered in handwriting. The first sentence ended in an exclamation point, and the words that preceded it were, "Richard, you are a writer." It was like a diagnosis, but the opposite of one where you're told you're going to die. This one told me I was going to live forever. She went on for a full page, praising the emotional force and maturity of my prose. She even told me that she had had her husband read it, and he had reacted the same way. I have no idea who her husband was or what his qualifications were, other than that he was a reader and a stranger, and he'd responded to something that I had written. That made two people who thought I was a writer. The first two. To be clear, no human being had ever responded to anything I had ever written in this way. The only reactions I'd ever received to my TV scripts were from people I knew and loved. And they all said that, yes, this sounded like an A-team episode or whatever. But suddenly, here was a college professor of literature telling me that I had talent as an actual writer, not just TV stuff, but the sort of stuff that ended up in magazines and books. In fact, she said she was close friends with the editor of Isaac Asimov's science fiction magazine, and that, with my permission, she would like to share the story with him and see if she could get it published. I couldn't fucking believe it. I decided to take the summer off from scriptwriting and devote those months exclusively to producing more short stories. I gave myself a generous schedule, hoping to complete three more. One in June, one in July, and one in August. School had ended. Michelle was coming back from Yale soon, and my summer stretched out in front of me like a shimmering path of sunlight on ocean waves. I had a new power. Now it was time to use it. That was Thursday, May 9th. Michelle came home on Saturday, May 11th. Then, on Tuesday, May 14th, 1985, just 2 miles from my house in Monterey Park, an intruder entered the home of William Doy and his disabled wife, Lillian. It was later determined he gained entry from an open window. He walked into the master bedroom and immediately shot the 66-year-old William Doy in the face with a .22 semi-automatic pistol, and then beat the dying man into unconsciousness. He then attacked William's 56-year-old wife, Lillian Doy, binding her hands with thumb cuffs and raping her repeatedly. This man, known at the time only as the Walk-In Killer or the Valley Intruder, had already murdered 6 people, most of whom lived and died within 10 miles of my house. In the summer of 1985, this unknown man would go on an insanely, almost unbelievably violent killing spree. In the middle of May, I didn't know any of this, but by the beginning of June, everyone in America, and maybe the world, knew there was a serial killer loose in Southern California. And by then, the press had given him a name, the Night Stalker. Aside from the insanely vicious rapes and murders that were taking place all around me, it was a pretty good summer. Michelle and I were still together, still hanging out, still seeing movies, still having sex. So no complaints there. Did she seem a little distant? Did something about her sex life feel slightly off, slightly out of sync? Maybe. Or maybe I'm coloring the past based on what I know of the future. I had dug out the Daniel Cohen book, not the copy I had borrowed from the Brightwood School Library 10 years ago, but my own personal hardback copy that I asked for and received the following Christmas. I was deep into writing my second short story, one that I felt was even better than the first. Professor Mandelker had given me her P.O. box number, and as soon as I was done, I was going to mail this one off to her. Plus, I was still waiting to hear if she'd had any luck getting the first one published. My second story was about two childhood friends, now adults, both of whom had dreams of becoming famous magicians, but only one of whom actually succeeded. I wanted the Daniel Cohen book to be the thing that connected them as children, that stoked their dreams of the unknown. But as I started to reread it, now as an 18-year-old, something hit me right between the eyes. Something that had been there all along, but I'd never noticed. Daniel Cohen was a skeptic, a former managing editor of Science Digest magazine. Passages in the book that I had skimmed over as a kid now glared at me like harsh red neon lights. Like this one in the chapter about Bigfoot. Quote, "What on earth has created this great plague of big, hairy monsters? One obvious, though partial answer is hoaxes. The abominable snowman and his American relatives, the Sasquatch and Bigfoot, have both been popular and well-publicized for some years now. If someone wanted to make up a story about seeing or being attacked by a monster, what more familiar type of monster could they choose than the big hairy type? Hoaxers are depressingly unimaginative. Then too, if one wanted to dress up like a monster in order to fool others, it is much easier to disguise oneself as an abominable snowman type than, say, a fire-breathing dragon. In the case of the Grahamsville gorilla, for example, the police actually discovered a gorilla costume in someone's car. In a pinch, an old fur coat and fur hat might serve to fool the unwary, particularly at night." And then later in the book, while discussing The Interrupted Journey by John G. Fuller, a book about the Betty and Barney Hill UFO abduction, Cohen concludes, quote, "What does all of this mean? Are we being invaded by some weird bunch of extraterrestrials? Frankly, the evidence does not support such an alarming conclusion. Are all the stories hoaxes and hallucinations? Symptoms such as loss of memory, severe anxiety, and other unpleasant reactions strongly suggest that many of those who report such experiences are in a disturbed psychological state. In any event, they do not make the most reliable of witnesses. Some of the other stories are almost certainly sheer fiction, made up either by some practical joker or by a writer of sensational books." I grabbed a couple more of Daniel Cohen's books off my shelf, including another favorite of mine, In Search of Ghosts. Same thing. An overall tone of, isn't it weird how some people believe in really stupid shit? I was heartbroken, but not too surprised. Of course this is the tone his books would take, especially if he wanted them shelved in school libraries. Sensational subject matter was fine as long as it was presented in a frame of casual skepticism. How could I have not seen this when I was a kid? Well, because at the time, it was amazing to see any book about this subject matter at all. The very fact that it existed felt like some sort of implicit endorsement, and back then it was all I had. I put Monsters, Giants, and Little Men from Mars back on my shelf and didn't look at it again until I did this podcast. That summer, Michelle and I spent the 4th of July with her mom, Barbara, up at Rick and Jerry's house in Lake Arrowhead. Rick and Jerry were friends of Michelle's mom and the first gay couple I ever personally knew. When it got dark, they took us out into the middle of Lake Arrowhead on their boat, and Michelle and I lay flat on our backs, staring up into the endless night sky, watching fireworks explode what felt like just inches from our eyes. Back home in the San Gabriel Valley, the Night Stalker was having a very busy week. On July 2nd, he drove to Arcadia, and with no real plan in mind, wandered into the home of Mary Louise Cannon, where he beat her half to death with a lamp, and then proceeded to stab her to death with a 10-inch butcher knife he found in her kitchen. Then, on July 5th, he went one town over to Sierra Madre and attacked a 16-year-old girl, bludgeoning her with a tire iron and then attempting to strangle her with a telephone cord. When sparks appeared, he took it as a sign that Jesus Christ was trying to save her, so he left. I guess he figured Jesus was cool with his other murders in general because, on July 7th, our Night Stalker returned to my hometown, Monterey Park, where he broke into the home of Joyce Lucille Nelson and stomped on her face with his sneaker-clad shoe until she died. 2 weeks later, he bought a machete before breaking into the Glendale home of Maxon and Layla Needing. He attacked them in their bed, hacking them with the machete, and then finally killing them both with a .22-caliber gunshot to their heads. Once they were dead, he continued to mutilate their corpses with the machete. Then, before sunrise, he drove 25 minutes up the 5 freeway to Sun Valley, where he broke into the home of Chanarong and Somkid Kovanath. He shot 32-year-old Chanarong in the face, killing him instantly. Then he tied up their 8-year-old son and proceeded to beat and rape Somkid before dragging her through the house, insisting she reveal the locations of all of their valuables, and then forcing her to swear on Satan when she said there was nothing more to take from them. At a certain point, we all have to come to terms with the world we live in. Bad things can happen to anyone at any time. No one who has ever been in a car accident planned to be in a car accident that day. Up until the very second it happens, every driver lives in a world where driving a car is nothing more than a mundane task, until it isn't. And of course, no one gets into bed at night calculating the immediate risk of being hacked to death with a machete. So, that July, Michelle and I and all our friends and families went about our lives, completely aware that these horrific events were happening literally all around us, but never letting it break through the thin membrane of our consciousness that protects us from going absolutely insane with fear every waking moment of every day of our lives. It was just something hovering out there, like cancer or an asteroid, statistically possible, but not probable, howling in the distance like a car alarm or a wolf, vaguely unsettling, but not immediately threatening. Not yet. The act of going on about your business and ignoring existential threats was well known to us in America in the 1980s. The pride of our national bicentennial, just a few years earlier, had devolved into a constant, grinding, low-level fear. The looming threat of nuclear war with the Soviet Union clouded our hopes for the future. It was imprinted into our minds that one day, any day, we might suddenly hear civil defense sirens blaring out across the Los Angeles basin, and it would mean, more or less, that the world was about to end. My friends seemed evenly divided about how they would respond. Half had some vague plan about how they'd escape the initial blast somehow, and then survive in the post-apocalyptic landscape that we all pictured being like a Mad Max movie. The other half would simply say, "If they drop the bomb, I hope it lands on me. Fast, clean, painless vaporization." I was in this camp. None of that horrific aftermath where the living envy the dead for me. I preferred to be one of the dead everyone envied. My fears had so many levels back then, each radiating out like rippling rings on the surface of a still pond. The furthest ring out was nuclear war. That was on the other side of the world. Closer in was getting drafted, something that we thought might really happen in 1985. Political commentators kept referring to the wars in Central America as, quote, our next Vietnam. Was this really possible? It seemed unlikely, but you never knew. The closest ring of fear was the fear of failure at selling a script, or failure at being a successful writer. That cut right to the heart of my identity. Next to that was the fear of Michelle. Michelle sleeping with someone else, falling in love with someone else, leaving me. These two things always felt connected. If I could just succeed as a writer, sell a script, sell a short story, somehow that would make me a worthy boyfriend, somebody worth loving, someone worth hanging on to. And now, somewhere between the rings of nuclear war and Michelle breaking my heart, was this new thing. A hyper-motivated serial killer bouncing around my neighborhood, armed with a gun and a machete and a telephone cord or whatever, just looking for the next place to land and make his mark. Would it surprise you to learn that my solution to conquering these nagging fears was to spend all day working on my short stories? Once I was into it, I was completely submerged into a world where nothing could hurt me. The magic of creating something is that it makes you feel somehow invulnerable, even immortal. So I had a measure of protection, or at least I did, until the end of July. That was when Professor Mandelker told me that she had been unable to get my short story placed with Isaac Asimov's magazine, and that while she liked my second story, it didn't quite move her in the way the first one did. This was all it took to pierce my armor. My excitement and optimism about writing short stories seemed to instantly morph into desperation and dread, the same feeling I was beginning to have when I wrote my TV scripts. When the end result becomes more important than the process, you're fucked. I didn't know that then. But the very fact that a slight dimming of my prospects of selling something could result in the work becoming almost impossible to do should have been my first clue. But the truth is, I was exhausted. I'd been at this writing thing for 2 solid years, and so far, nothing. I was 18 years old and hadn't had a single sale. How long was this going to take? And how much longer could I survive this cycle I was in with Michelle? She came home for 3 weeks at Christmas, 2 weeks at spring break, and 3 months for summer. Each time she returned, we went through the stressful rhythm of getting back into things. And then it seemed like no sooner did we get back into our groove than she'd be getting ready to leave again. It stressed us out. We spent precious hours and days fighting. And through it all, this strange ambivalence I felt from her, this sort of one foot in, one foot out of our relationship that at the moment meant everything to me. By mid-August, the familiar feelings of despair and depression descended. Our time together was growing short. Had I done everything I possibly could to re-cement our commitment to each other? Had I succeeded in locking in at least one of the essential aspects of my life? The writing was drying up, but what about my relationship with Michelle? Could I at least depend on that? On the night of August 8th, the Night Stalker turned up in Diamond Bar, of all places. At around 2:30 a.m., he entered the home of Elias and Sakina Abawaf, again through an open window. He immediately killed Elias with a single gunshot wound to the head and then proceeded to beat and rape the handcuffed Sakina, making her swear on Satan that she wouldn't scream as he assaulted her. The following Saturday night, August 17th, Tim, Herb, and Larry came over to my house. It was a pretty typical hangout without much of a plan. We watched whatever came up on cable. We ordered takeout from Shakey's, and Herb and I drove down to Atlantic Square and picked up the pizzas and garlic knots at about 9 p.m. Tim and Larry drank from my dad's endless supply of Coke and 7-Up, and Herb, as usual, helped himself to a box of my mom's white wine. We watched Saturday Night Live at 11:30, and then SCTV on Channel 9 at 1 a.m. I had the vague expectation that they'd start leaving when SCTV was over at 1:30, but instead, everyone just kept hanging out in my living room. Tim was wide awake. He explained he hadn't slept at all the previous night, but had instead slept all day, waking up just before coming over. When we asked him why, he told us that he was too afraid to sleep because he kept thinking he heard someone sneaking up the back stairs to his second floor apartment. The thing was, Tim had no air conditioning. None of us did. So in August, in Los Angeles, that meant you slept with your windows open, which this August meant that you were leaving yourself wide open to the Night Stalker. With his windows open, Tim could hear everything for a block in all directions, and the sounds all morphed into that of an unknown murderer heading for his bedroom. We had all heard about the latest attack in Diamond Bar. That had been 9 nights ago. And with each passing night with no new attacks, the gnawing suspense kept building. We knew he was out there. We knew he was going to strike. We just didn't know where, or when, or who. We started talking about how we all slept with our windows open, and we had all had the same scary thought. What if somehow, tonight, he picks my house? It was about 2 in the morning now, prime Night Stalker murder time. We were all wide awake. Herb tried to be reasonable and logical. What were the actual odds that this guy would pick any one of our houses? But that's when Larry laid it out. He said what we were all thinking and feeling, but hadn't quite articulated. We'd all lived through various crazed murderers in Southern California before, but as Larry put it, quote, they had all stuck to the serial killer's golden rule, only hookers and bums. And even those that strayed from that menu only preyed on women, so here we were, 4 white guys who for the first time in our lives felt like we could be victims, just like anyone else. This guy was killing everybody. Old people, young people, single people, married people, black, white, Asian, Hispanic. His only type seemed to be living human beings. Everyone had a reason to be afraid. And then, for the first time ever, we talked about guns. None of us owned guns. None of our families owned guns. But Tim said he was actually considering buying one. Herb gave him shit. What was he really planning to do with it? Most people, he said, who owned a gun end up getting killed by their own gun. But Tim had a plan. He was going to build a fake sleeping body in his bed using pillows like they do in the movies. Then he would strategically leave one window open in his apartment, the one that led directly into his bedroom. Tim would hide across the room just out of sight behind his dresser. When the Night Stalker came in and headed for the decoy body in the bed, Tim would have a clear, easy shot. I said that sometimes even a clear, easy shot is hard to make if you're not trained on how to use a firearm, but he assured me he wasn't going to take only one shot. Once he started shooting, he wasn't going to stop until the gun was empty. That sounded pretty badass to me. His logic was, he was going to be awake all night anyway. Why not protect himself and even have a chance to be the guy that killed the Night Stalker? He was very confident he wouldn't end up going to prison. Are you kidding me? He said. The city will probably throw me a parade. Larry was the only one of us who had a dog, and he said that once she started barking, the Night Stalker would go looking for easier prey. Personally, I liked Tim's idea. There was something very Kolchak about it. Luring the monster in and then dealing with it on its own terms. I was still young enough to imagine that real life sometimes played out just like a TV show, and naive enough to believe that the object of our collective fear could be taken down by a normal person, and not in a hail of police bullets. I was fine with the police bullets, but I was angry at the fear and helplessness that this Night Stalker made me feel. I was already feeling scared and helpless that summer. So, it would feel really good to deal some of that back to the person who deserved it most. We kept talking like this for hours, and then we dropped the subject of the Night Stalker and went on to other things. Our girlfriends, our favorite TV shows and movies, our plans to become rich and famous. Where we'd all be in 20 years from now, assuming we weren't murdered by the Night Stalker. We all knew what we were doing, but no one came right out and said it. We were waiting for the sun to rise. Once it did, we'd be safe for one more day. And when it did, just after 5 a.m., one by one, each of my friends left my house until I was the only one left. Together, we had made it through the night. 2 weeks later, based on a variety of evidence, law enforcement officials finally settled on a suspect in the Night Stalker case, a 25-year-old repeat offender named Ricardo Leyva Munoz Ramirez, better known to us now as simply Richard Ramirez. On August 29th, a mugshot of Ramirez, who had been arrested just 1 year earlier on an auto theft charge, was released to the press. They also had a message for Ramirez. "We know who you are now, and soon everyone else will. There will be no place you can hide." On the day this happened, Richard Ramirez was just returning to the Los Angeles area after a bus trip to Tucson, Arizona, to visit his brother. He wandered into a convenience store in East Los Angeles, just about 4 miles from my house. And there he saw his mugshot on the front of every newspaper in the store. He panicked and immediately fled. But two women had seen him and made the connection. In the next couple of minutes, Ramirez made two failed attempts at carjacking, but was thwarted each time. And finally, he'd drawn enough of a crowd, who thought he was just some asshole trying to steal a car, that a mob of more than 10 people chased him down and finally caught up with him on Hubbard Street in Boyle Heights. Once they had him, they beat him viciously and relentlessly, almost killing him, before police arrived. It was only later that they were informed who it was they had actually caught. They had had no idea he was the Night Stalker. I was pretty thrilled once the story came out. I couldn't stop imagining Ramirez running in animal fear as a group of fine citizens chased him and caught him and beat him half to death. It seemed like justice. And as we all know, justice, real justice, rarely comes to those who deserve it, and almost never in so satisfying a way. But then, it took 3 years for his trial to begin, and 4 more before he was convicted and sentenced to death. In that time, Ramirez had acquired a fan club and was regularly visited in prison by devoted supporters, including a number of women desperate to sleep with him and, in their most intimate hopes, marry him. It was this that years later, Larry would joke about on his first night performing stand-up comedy at the Improv on Melrose in Hollywood. "This guy rapes and kills his way across California, and he's getting marriage proposals. Meanwhile, I can't get a date." In 1996, Richard Ramirez married Doreen Leoy on San Quentin's death row. But sadly, the marriage did not last. And happily, he finally died on June 7th, 2013. Not in California's gas chamber, but from complications of B-cell lymphoma. His body was never claimed. Author Daniel Cohen and his wife Susan met their own real-life monster on December 21st, 1988, when their only child, 20-year-old Theodora, was killed in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 when it exploded over Lockerbie, Scotland. The convicted bomber was sent to prison in 2001 and then released in 2009 on the grounds of compassion after being diagnosed with terminal prostate cancer. He died 3 years later. Michelle had already left for New Haven and her junior year at Yale when Ramirez was captured. We talked about it on the phone, and it was a couple of weeks later before she finally admitted to me that last spring, just before coming home, she'd slept with another guy. Apparently it was not serious, no big deal, and it had only happened once, and they weren't really even friends anymore. I had no way to process what she was telling me, other than to feel that even though she said she still loved me, and we had spent the whole summer together, that I'd somehow been kicked into outer space and was now floating further and further into a never-ending darkness. I knew the expectation was that I would receive this news with sophistication and maturity. So I faked it. And as most of you know, nothing hurts worse than pretending that something doesn't hurt at all. Monsters come in all shapes and sizes. Sometimes the monsters are like Bigfoot and make you feel lonely. Sometimes the monsters come from a swamp in Louisiana and make you feel like you can conquer anything. Sometimes the monsters are just seriously broken people, emotionally deformed, sending their demons loose into our world with absolutely no sense of the pain and destruction they leave behind. And sometimes the monsters that really hurt you aren't even monsters at all. Those are the tricky ones, because those are the ones you have no defense against. Your window is always open, and you'll always let them in. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Mima Kazarin. Please join us next time as we celebrate Christmas in July with our very first ever non-nonfiction book, A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. Until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.